Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneer Zalman Neufeld. Authentically Orthodox, A Tradition-Bound Faith in American Life, written by Zev Aleph and published by Wayne State University Press in 2020, challenges the current historical paradigm in the study of Orthodox Judaism and other tradition-based faith communities in the United States. Paying attention to lived religion, the book moves beyond sermons and synagogues and examines the webs of experiences mediated by any number of American cultural forces. Aleph lucidly explores Orthodox Judaism's engagement with Jewish law, youth culture, and gender, and how this religious group has been affected by its indigenous context. Zev Aleph is a chief academic officer of Hebrew Theological College and associate professor of Jewish history at Touro College. I'm so glad his new book has brought him to our program. Welcome, Zev.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this book?
Sure. So my first book was really centered around Reform Judaism in the 19th century. It was titled Who Rules the Synagogue? And its central theme was around concepts of power and authority, principally around the Reform movement, again, 19th century, 1800s. And it made me think a lot about power dynamics and how religion summons or compels its adherence into action. And I thought there was a really nifty study to be done on American Orthodoxy, this principally in the 20th century. The book has, I think, two articles that I had published previously. And I intuited, you know what, some of that earlier work, it resonated with this theme. And so I moved forward and I developed a research plan and some micro histories to really explore what we mean by authentic, what we mean by authority and authenticity in Jewish life, particularly the Orthodox community.
Right, right. So speaking of authentic and authenticity, this is clearly a really important theme for you in this book. What did Rabbi Leonard Gewirtz mean by authentic Jews in 1961 when he wrote about this?
Right. So he wrote his book about authenticity. And he's not the first one, certainly. Already back in Germany, Hirsch and others were using authenticity to describe tradition-bound faith. But what Leonard Gewirtz in a book, not sure how well it read it was at the time, he speaks to an authenticity which I found really interesting. And I think it betokened a sentiment of Orthodox practitioners really around mid-century, which isn't, authenticity isn't the type of faith that best approximates the religion of Moses or the Gaon of Vilna. Doesn't mean a historical assessment of how of a faith's fidelity to a more ancient time and clime. But instead, this is the sociologist Regina Bendix made this argument as well. Authenticity speaks to a feeling, something really hard for historians to deduce. Which is how does religion make me feel that what I am doing is correct? Not which religion is correct, but how do people in a faith community, how are they self-reassured that what they're doing is to them the most authentic permutation of a religious experience?
All right. And is this the definition that you feel most comfortable with when you think of what authenticity means in the context of your study?
Yeah, from a scholarly perspective, I think it's really interesting. And I think it gets us beyond questions of editing religion, of historical change. I think, and so much of my work is to not to argue with the great scholar of modern Jewish history, Jacob Katz, but is to complicate the narrative, particularly in the context of America, where we're talking about the New World. There was a blank slate, a tabula rasa, and what religion does, and I'm trained as an American religious historian, so much of my work tries to map the American Jewish experience, the Jewish experience in America, that is, on to a broader religious landscape. When we talk about authenticity and how we can measure how historical figures, and by here I don't mean the elites, but the rank and file, I thought that that's a really comfortable way for us to be more sophisticated about what we mean about tradition and religion.
Right. It's interesting because I think that both many Orthodox and certainly ultra-Orthodox people, practitioners themselves, as well as I think a good number of non-Orthodox Jewish people, actually view the Orthodox Judaism very much in the model that it sounds like you're critiquing or rejecting. In other words, they view contemporary Orthodox Judaism as the closest approximation to what used to be in the kind of Judaism that either was practiced in Eastern Europe, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, and even by extension, the kind of Judaism that Moses practiced, so to speak.
And that's not to be dismissed, right? That's not to be dismissed. A fidelity to a religious community might be based on feeling of this is how my grandparents, this is how my proverbial Bubby and Zadie did it. And if somebody's going to do it differently, how dare they? That's not how my great grandparents actualized their Judaism. And so that's not to disagree, but I'll take another example, something that's not in the book. Take separation of church and state and public funds for Jewish day schools. So in immediate post-war period, nothing could have been more anathema. At the height of the so-called day school movement from the 40s until the 60s, no government funds. American exceptionalism, this is where I borrow from my teacher, Jonathan Sarna, is predicated on a certain civic understanding of religion's place in the United States. And so heaven forfend should we try to retrieve government funding for our day schools. We're going to do it ourselves because that would be to blur that separation. Moving into the 1970s and 1980s of identity politics, no, to the contrary. In an era of multiculturalism, we as a particular community are entitled to government funds, whether they come in busing, in paying for nutrition, whatever it might be. And so that change, now here we're not talking about ritual, we're talking about that point of departure of how we're going to fund the day school is predicated on what is the most authentic link between religion and state in the United States. And in a span of a couple of decades, all of it changes. I'll give you another example that has nothing to do with Orthodoxy. If you take a look at the Reform Responsa on homosexuality, Much of it was changed. The perception was changed by whether or not a gay couple can scaffold a family around their way of life. Nothing to do with scripture necessarily and within the Reform movement. But when we talk about what is the family unit supposed to look like, the Reform movement fundamentally changes from the 70s to the 80s on the very serious issue of the gay community. They were they had already offered resolutions from a civil rights perspective. But it's the changed perspective on family life that changes. And so authenticity, as you point out, not always historically, but what feels right in the moment.
Right, right.
So, it's not, so therefore, it's not just orthodoxy. It's really everybody.
Right, right. I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that it seems to me that with, I mean, you could think in terms of the changing attitudes towards homosexuality, if you think about the history of the American Psychological Association, you know, how it changed radically from including homosexuality in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, basically calling it, like a mental illness, to, rejecting that attitude and saying, no, this is actually, a part of quote unquote.
And that's exactly
life.
My point. When the DSM changes its policy, that is showing how American cultural and scientific and political and social forces are mediating how we as religion people, religion folk, are absorbing that. And that is critically important in the American context to understand a moment in time.
Right, right. No, I understand that. I guess I'm just saying it's interesting to me because no one in the APA, as far as I know, has ever felt that the APA represents the truest form of psychological understanding since the beginning of time. In other words, they understand that they're a contemporary organization doing their best to make sense of the human psyche within the context of their period and so on. Whereas Orthodox Judaism, this is my original point, both for the practitioners as well as for many outsiders, seem to have an understanding that Orthodox Judaism itself as a form of faith is either predicated on or strives to be or something, the closest model to quote unquote traditional or historical Judaism as it's existed for hundreds and thousands of years. And so it's interesting to
me. I think sometimes you're right. You're right. I think you're absolutely right. But I also think that in the yeshiva world today, for instance,
for the ultra-Orthodox world.
Well, right. There is an intuitive understanding that there are more people, not talking about quantitatively, not necessarily qualitatively. Quantitatively, there are more young men studying in a traditional yeshiva than ever before. And because of American affluence, because of the social systems in which all Americans, and Orthodox Jews included, operate, there has been a change regime in the curriculum, in what is in what particularly men, Orthodox men, are entitled to. And I think intuitively we understand that historically, again, quantitatively, not necessarily qualitatively. I'm not speaking to the rigor of Talmud study in Volozhin compared to a yeshiva in the United States.
In Eastern Europe, sure.
In terms of in sheer number, I think they would understand that historically we're in a different place. But what makes sense in our moment in time would be what is most authentic. And that has to do with the socioeconomics of 2021.
Sure. No, I understand. To step back a little bit for listeners who are not familiar with all of the context that we're talking about, let's begin with something simple. How do you define Orthodox Judaism for people that are not familiar with the specifics of the Jewish denominationalism in America?
Well, Orthodox Judaism, I think, very simply, would be the community that claims an adherence to Jewish law, the Talmud, and the Bible in the strictest possible way. That does it in that sense. It's not, I wouldn't call it a form of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism in Christianity refers to biblicism, strict fidelity to halakha, to Jewish law, owes to the process of Jewish law. And so, but it's a community that places Jewish law front and center of their lives in terms of that framework. But it's also a social construct, certainly.
Right, right. That certainly gives us some food for thought, how this all works out. To set the stage a little bit more, your book has so much rich history. It's really a pleasure to read through. And obviously, we won't be able to cover all of it in the time today, but I'd like to get to a couple of things. First of all, you talk about a dispute between Jacob Mordechai and Isaac Harbi. Who were they, and what exactly was their dispute about?
You're going to make me go back to the 19th century. So in the 1820s, Isaac Harbi, not necessarily the most learned Jew, but a very literate American, a playwright, a journalist, in Charleston, South Carolina, he spearheads the Reform Society of Israelites in Charleston, which at the time was one of the largest Jewish communities in the United States, about 500.
In the 1820s, you're talking about?
In the 1820s, correct. On the other hand, Jacob Mordechai is easily one of the top two most learned Jews in the United States. He takes umbrage at this idea of reform, and he's the very first one to describe himself as, at least that I'm aware of, as an Orthodox Jew, obviously using nomenclature from Protestant America. And so that is the very beginning of this binary between Reform and Orthodox. And throughout the 19th century, I argue, each one is laying claim to a certain level of authenticity, whether it's this is what the Bible meant. And by suggesting what the Bible meant is to achieve a level of authenticity. This is what the rabbis meant. This, whatever that type of rhetoric, that discourse that happens, and it's a cantankerous discourse throughout the 19th century, is all about authenticity.
Right. And how did they ground their arguments in terms of the kinds of sacred texts that they relied on? You argue that was the way that they kind of structured their arguments, or the sources that they used to claim authenticity in America was different than the way that rabbis previously or at the time in the European context were making these kinds of arguments.
Well, certainly Jews in the United States were looked at as biblical people. Even Christians that want to know how to read the Bible, ask my neighbor the Jew how to read this. So they were keepers of this book. And so restoring the Bible, the Torah, to the apex of Jewish discourse, you know, to some listeners might sound very obvious, but no such thing. Certainly in the medieval modern period, and others have written about this, the Talmud. The oral tradition takes a precedence. That's what's studied principally in male yeshivas today. Orthodox yeshivas today is the Talmud. The Bible, on the other hand, because of what it represents to America, America is this biblical country. Abraham Lincoln explains in the second inaugural that both sides read the same Bible. It's a biblical war of interpretation, particularly around slavery in that case. So the Bible is restored to that heightened place in Jewish religious discourse.
Right. And what innovation did American Orthodox rabbis introduce in the 19th century, inspired by their Christian counterparts?
Well, if you think, it's not just America, but rabbis as well. If you think about the sermon. The sermon was an innovation. In more ancient times, a rabbi delivered a sermon maybe twice a year, before the high holidays and before Passover. But when it comes to the every week sermon, that's something pretty much brand new. The Jewish educational system starts to develop a little more fully. Sunday school, certainly, in the 19th century, as public schooling becomes de jure, Jews take to it. These are the golden citadels. It's not until much later that when the Catholics developed the parochial school, the Jews absorbed that. But certainly a certain way of life, a certain dress. Rabbis 19th century wore canonicals, but so did Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch wear canonicals.
In Germany.
In Germany, yes. So you have, in terms of
canonicals are the formal attire that pastors, yes. Christian pastors were wearing at the time.
Correct. Yes. Thanks for clarifying. Yes.
Right. So rabbis are wearing
trappings. Right. And so the trappings of what religion ought to look like. When a congregation is ready to move past the storefront, they remodel a church, which has moved the a church moved from one kind of space to another. In fact, that's how Isaac Meir Wise, the great architect of Reform Judaism, how he he collapses men and women together, gets rid of separate seating, not out of any theological paradigm, but because his congregation in Albany had purchased a site that used to be a church. They did not have separate pews. So he said, we're going to continue this way. The pragmatism of American Jewish life, I think, singled it out among its other sites around the globe.
Right. And your book includes, as you mentioned, a whole bunch of micro histories that look at, you know, individual fascinating moments in American Jewish Orthodox history. What is the broad theme that all of these micro histories in your mind substantiate?
Well, I take that there are 9 micro histories within 3 different sections having to do with Orthodox schooling and education, having to do with halakha, Jewish law, and then gender, particularly around masculinity. I thought that much of the scholarship, I don't disagree with that scholarship, have focused on how feminism has impacted on American Judaism and American Orthodoxy, either the resistance to it or the absorption of it. But I thought that masculinity is something that we take for granted. Male space is something, that's that third section. But what I tried to argue, and this was, I tried to be as interdisciplinary as I could, is showing how legal, political forces. So, for example, the ability to wear a yarmulke while playing high school basketball, actually, where I am
caps.
In Chicago, Illinois. Skull caps, yes. And the legal fight of whether or not you have to wear a yarmulke and what meaning is taken out of that debate, which ultimately had a chance but was denied to be taken up by the United States Supreme Court in the early 1980s. That debate is charged by expectations of Jewish identity. Of course, Jews wear a yarmulke, men, that is, in this case. That is how we exercise our identity in this period of multiculturalism. I demonstrate regionalism makes a big difference. Why a school in Baltimore, a modern Orthodox school in Baltimore, rises and falls with certain expectations of a very indigenous Catholic ecclesiastical culture. Also, another feature is folkways, how traditions, this is in the area of halakha, Jewish law. And I look at an overlooked interesting point, which is peanut oil, which may or may not be used, according to who you ask for, the context of this chapter, on Passover, might be forbidden, and how different halachic, this Jewish law folkways migrate from Europe, one from Eastern Europe and another one from Hungary and ultimately from Israel. How that impacts foodways in Jewish life. And I take themes from American culture. And I look at how that is mediated, how that mediates, and how that interacts with religious life. And that's the common theme threaded throughout.
Right. So
eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter,
broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for that. So, speaking of peanut oil, what exactly was the debate over, and why was there a question about whether or not peanut oil would be permissible for Orthodox Jews on the Passover holiday?
So the reason why this, I don't think, I've made an argument, I think a cogent one, why this is not just a pedantic issue, is because there's something called kitniot. It is an extra juridical, an extra halachic matter on Passover, developed by Ashkenazic, that's German, Eastern European rabbis, in the 13th and 14th centuries, which is a stringency that, I should start from the very beginning. On Passover, halacha, Jewish law, dictates that Jews cannot consume, or own, for that matter, leavened bread. They have matzah instead. It's not leaven. There's no yeast. There was concern in the beginning in earnest in the 13th century, among Ashkenazic, that's again Germanic rabbinic authorities, that other items, legumes, beans, peas, may have, well, there are two possibilities. Number one, they may have kernels of wheat inside. When you produce them, when you bake them, they could produce chametz, leavened bread. Then the other possible concern is that you can make these legume items, these food items, food stuff, into something that might appear like bread, and people become confused on Passover and consume bread. So those are the two reasons. Now, certain foods were unknown to Jews in the 13th century. One of them, it's an American product crop, is peanuts. Peanuts don't make it to Europe until the end of the 19th century. And so, and peanut oil, particularly after World War II, because the U.S. Department of Agriculture is trying to reserve other sources of oil for the war effort. Peanut oil was not good to for tanks, I suppose. So all of a sudden it becomes in vogue, and Planters Peanuts, for example, produces a Passover oil. They are the Passover oil, do they contend? And all of this is to say is that this is an extra textual. The Gemara, the Talmud, does not speak about kitniot whatsoever. And so this is a really great way, I think, to understand rabbinic intuition, what is or is not acceptable. And whereas the Eastern European folkway proffers a lenient position in the early 20th century, in the post-Holocaust period, a Hungarian folkway, in fact, there was a speech delivered in Hungary by the grandfather of the Grand Rabbi of Satmar, of the Satmar Rav, that outlawed peanuts when it finally appeared in Hungary at the beginning of the 20th century. So they took these things very, very seriously. And so you see how competing folkways militate against one another. And you can remove the halachic logic, the Talmudic logic. Other areas, you can say, well, this position just seemed more cogent to another. But here, this is above the page of the Talmud. And so you really get to see rabbinic intuition combating with one another in the 20th century. So that's why I thought it was particularly interesting, and how eventually, I think at our moment, there is no kosher supervising agency which authorizes peanut oil. This is only 40 years after Planters was considering itself the Passover oil.
So the Hungarians won, is what you're saying, for the moment.
The Hungarians won again, and part of it was an Israeli folkway, no less than Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first chief rabbi of Eretz Israel. Wasn't in Israel at the time. He dies in 1935. but he works on he fights desperately to use cottonseed oil when other oils, because of drought, were no longer available, and he was the rabbi in Yaffa. And he combated this. That's evidence that the Israeli folkway was not hospitable to new foodways either. And so in a post-67 world, 1967 that is, the Hungarian folkway bolstered by an Israeli folkway absolutely vanquishes that Eastern European variety. Yes.
Right, right.
Really. Maybe I'm over-dramatizing.
I think it's fascinating. So thank you for
I made it into chapter one, after all.
What?
I made it into chapter one, so I was sort of hoping that people would enjoy it so they can get to chapters 2 through 9. So I was banking on that.
It worked for me. speaking of chapter two, you talk about the status of bat mitzvahs, the coming of age celebrations for young girls, yes, and how the Orthodox understanding and appreciation of these ritual celebrations has evolved tremendously since the 1970s. What was the status of these ritual celebrations at the time, and how have they evolved among the Orthodox?
The very first bat mitzvah ceremony we know of was for Judith Kaplan in the early 1920s, the daughter of Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, a prominent member of the left flank of the conservative movement. Eventually, he and his son-in-law, Ira Eisenstein, found what we call today Reconstructionist Judaism, but it was considered to be a conservative ritual. Reform had confirmation ceremonies modeled after a certain Protestant a ritual for boys and girls more advanced, usually in their late teens. Orthodoxy had the concept of a bat mitzvah in principle of when she reaches the age of maturity, does a 12-year-old girl, but not a ceremony equivalent to the bar mitzvah. The bat mitzvah then was a conservative thing for all intents and purposes.
Conservative Judaism.
This is where I bar.
The conservative
Judaism
denomination.
Not religion. Yes, yes, thank you. Yes, yes. And so, but it becomes a very useful tool for Orthodox rabbis in the hinterland, right, in the American frontier. Another important American historical concept, Frederick Jackson Turner, of course, coins the term long ago, to demonstrate how the periphery can influence the center. And while I demonstrate that New York Jews are fully unaware of the popularization of the bat mitzvah ceremony for 12-year-old girls in Orthodox synagogues in the 1950s and 1960s, it's happening. It's happening because young families with young children, children, some of them might be girls, eventually to turn 12 years old, might appreciate such a thing. And because there needs to be a certain level of partnership with other spaces of Jewish life, reform and conservative, that it makes good sense. Now, not necessarily the bat mitzvah ritual as constructed in other conservative, eventually reform too, circles, but how can Orthodox Judaism architect a bat mitzvah ceremony that would be halachically legitimate or authentic, but was seen as absolutely necessary to compete in the Orthodox hinterland? And eventually, that's an example of how the periphery influences the center, and New York Jews come to embrace it, again, with a certain level of variety and circumspection as well.
All right. And so what does happen? I mean, in the 1970s, it seems to be still very much kind of a contested or opposed concept. But today, among the Orthodox and even the ultra-Orthodox, I know from my own background in the Hasidic ultra-Orthodox community, all of my sisters had some kind of bat mitzvah celebration, not identical to the bar mitzvah celebration for the boys, where they go to they read from the Torah in the synagogue itself, but some form of celebration, a significant public celebration nonetheless. So how did that attitudes and practices shift so dramatically over the course of a relatively short period of time, less than 50
right?
years?
Absolutely. And this is the exact opposite of our peanut oil story and speaks to your issue of what do we mean by authenticity. Whereas the issue of the permissibility of peanut oil on Passover is forgotten, so too is the thorny politic of bat mitzvah. Once it is authenticated in the hinterland, it seems good. This works. People, Orthodox Jews aren't becoming conservative Jews because of bat mitzvah. They're staying within the fold. It has proved its bona fides, and it can be migrated effectively to the Orthodox community in the East. Yeah. In the tri-state area and elsewhere. It also needed some time to be accepted in Boston and Atlanta for a variety of reasons. And so that's what's so interesting. And that's why I don't accept this idea of this unilateral so-called sliding to the right. It's far more complicated. Jews are moving in all sorts of directions. It matters in which arena we're talking about. If we're talking about food ways, it might be moved in one way. And if we're talking about lived religion and culture and ritual, it might move in a separate direction. It's the mess. It's why being a scholar of American religion is so much fun. It's quite messy.
Indeed. One thing that jumps out at me, speaking of the construction of authenticity, is that, as we were saying before, that for something to be quote unquote authentic, it doesn't mean that it actually existed in a previous era in Jewish history. It just means that it feels authentic for any number of reasons. And related to that, we see in the case of the bat mitzvah that possibly in order for something to ultimately be understood, a ritual or a practice to be understood as being authentic, it's what's really important. One of the things that are really important is that once it becomes an accepted practice, there's almost a requirement for a kind of amnesia that we need to forget that it was ever a contested issue. That for it to feel fully authentic, we have to believe, oh yes, this is the way it always was. And that to even kind of bring up the history of its contestation maybe creates a challenge to its authenticity, current authentic.
Sure, it's easy to have this right, and it's much easier to have historical amnesia in America, right? A relatively young. This is not to say about indigenous Native Americans, but in terms of what we think about now, in terms of being American, a relatively nascent culture. We don't have a landscape filled with castles, for example. It's much easier to achieve that level of amnesia, but no, not necessarily very different than with the Copernican turn, for example, trying to demonstrate, no, we always knew in the Bible, in our Christian thought or our Jewish thought, that Copernicus was right. We're going to forget about that earlier thought. Now, take some time. With science, with Darwin as well, social constructs. So I think it's always convenient to have a certain level of amnesia.
Right.
You say that about quarterbacks. It's always good to forget when you throw an interception.
Right. You forget the bad plays. It helps you go forward, certainly, sometimes. You mentioned already this issue of the lawsuit related to the wearing of yarmulkes, the male skullcaps that men in the Orthodox community wear. And the lawsuit, Menorah versus Illinois High School Association, was in 19 in the 1980s. Why was it that this issue of the legal protection for Orthodox high schoolers to wear these skullcaps while playing basketball, why did this only come up in the 1980s? In other words, what were Orthodox Jewish young men or boys doing prior to that in terms of their yarmulke wearing practices?
And so according to the strict letter of the law, halakha dictates that a male, we're talking about men, have to adorn a skull cap when praying and eating and studying Torah. But walking down the street, one need not do that. In fact, well known is that he's come up several times now. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch in Frankfurt demanded of his students that when they're studying general studies, secular topics in his day school, they are not allowed to wear yarmulkes. So much has been written among the history of yarmulke, but it's not until the 1980s in which it was a source of Jewish identity, of Jewish pride, to wear a yarmulke. So in that era of Ronald Reagan, I've used this word a number of times now, multiculturalism, it would only have appeared in the 70s or in the 80s. And there were other lawsuits taken up about an Orthodox Jew in the military, particularly in the Air Force, two cases that I'm aware of whether or not they could wear a yarmulke there. Actually, both cases they're turned down for the sake of uniformity, a value in the Air Force. But that's why it's happening in the 1980s. And the argument, it's not as if the Orthodox Jews are betraying the textual traditions of halacha. It'd be too easy to suggest that. It's much more complicated. The yarmulke stands freighted and it's filled with so much more meaning of fidelity to a way of life. And how can an Orthodox high school, this is Fassman election wasn't called yet. Yeshiva High School, associated with the Hebrew Theological College in Chicago, was a joint lawsuit together with Ida Crown Jewish Academy, the two major Orthodox high schools in the city at the time. They're arguing, how can we be Orthodox and not don yarmulkes while playing ball? And that's what the lawsuit's all about.
All right. I think it's just fascinating, again, thinking about authenticity. I think when a lot of people think about Orthodox Jews today, Orthodox Jewish men, one of the first things that come to mind is that these are the people that walk around, you know, that wear their yarmulkes all the time, you know, when they're in business, when they're walking down the street. And I think it's just fascinating to reflect on the fact that this was not always the way that things were done. Even in relatively recent history, many, if not most people who considered themselves and were considered by others to be Orthodox Jews, Orthodox Jewish men, did not wear their yarmulke in public spaces.
And yet, by the 1980s, it did not feel right. It wasn't authentic to look at earlier historical models. And that's what I find so interesting about how this augurs the place of authenticity in religious life.
Right, right. And speaking of youth culture and youth, young people, what they were doing religiously, you talk about an episode where the Mighty Mites appeared on a 1963 television game show. Who were the Mighty Mites, and why was this such a significant moment in American Orthodox Jewish culture?
So people older than I in the Orthodox community remember this quite well. And this is actually the article that first appeared. This is what germinated. This chapter germinated this idea of authenticity. So you have this yeshiva college, actually yeshiva university, because the team captain was a student from Stern College for Women. Team captain was a woman, which is quite interesting. They compete on the College Bowl. They first, as I recall, take down Louisville, and then a team from UNLV, and then lose to Temple, which obviously has certain religious resonance, and then the team captain had a very Jewish-sounding name. But they are the darlings, for a moment at least. More than 15 minutes of fame, though, for sure, of the Jewish world and the Orthodox world, that they can compete on this relatively new thing called the television. It's only that it makes its way into the American households in the 1950s, around the 1960s. So it's only now an established item, piece of furniture, and they're competing. And they're wearing yarmulkes. They insisted upon it.
Not the woman.
Not the woman. She was married, so she wore a hat on her head. The faculty advisor was not wearing a yarmulke, which was apparently in not of good taste to some Yeshiva University officials. But it's this great moment in which Jews have made it. They're in a game show, no less, a popular one, with sponsored by General Electric, and they're doing it well, and they know the answers, and the questions aren't ones based in the Talmud, but are part of highbrow American culture. They're asking about the Tudor dynasty, and so it's a terrific moment in which all eyes are on very visibly Orthodox Jews.
All right, and you feel that this helped either promote or solidify the idea that people that Orthodox Jews in America are able to be both kind of fully Orthodox and at the same time very much a part of the broader American culture and society.
Right, I think so. I mean, I felt echoes of it, and 2 years ago, it actually has a sad ending, or at least a deflating ending, is also at Yeshiva University when its basketball team had made it many rounds into the March Madness, into the Division III tournament. And I think, you know, as we're recording, they haven't lost in now a year and a half. I think they're 33-0, 36-0 in the streak. And that, in returning to basketball, that in with athletic prowess, again, Division III. So let's be clear, they're not competing against Duke and Michigan, but they're winning, and they're cool, and they're hitting three, and they're dunking. That's an incredible thing. And the entire, you got the feeling, again, about authenticity, that the American Jewish world, certainly the Orthodox one, was rallying around these basketball players. It was a really fascinating moment.
Right. I hear your excitement as someone who doesn't follow sports of any sort. I was unaware of these tremendous athletic achievements, but it's certainly interesting to reflect on. So shifting gears a little bit, you write about the struggles over women's Talmud study and women's prayer groups among the Orthodox. For people that are not familiar with the Orthodox community, it might seem rather perplexing. Isn't Talmud study understood by everyone as being an inherently good thing for all Jews to do, including women? What exactly was the conflict over in terms of women's participation in Talmud study and prayer groups?
Now, historically, and this jibes with other literacy levels in other faith communities and other general communities, is that the Talmud was designated for the men's curriculum. And that's how yeshivas were traditionally for a male space. And what I argue in the chapter is that the campaign to provide advanced Jewish literacy, and that's what the Talmud has come to represent, advanced Jewish literacy to women, was really not as much about feminism. The same people, for example, who were championing this, Rabbi Soloveitchik, was opposed to the ordination of women. It was not about feminism. But really was about encroaching on male space. And what does a space look like? And so I look at this battle, which I track it from the 50s onward, but really the central moment is in the 70s and 80s, when women's Talmud again comes to Yeshiva University, but also to the day schools, what it looks like. And that balance, that gender dynamic, I think was critically important to creating a structure. It always has. Gender is always at the forefront of religious studies, and I think no different here. But here, not about creating a women's space, but looking at how it impacts male space.
What were the arguments against women studying Talmud?
Oh, you have a proof text, for example, in Tractate Sota, which says
from the Talmud
as much, right, from the Talmud itself. But it was really a culture clash, excuse me. It was a question of what looks right. And whose rabbi are you going to believe? And certainly the modern Orthodox had a greatest of all champions from their perspective in Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, the great dean of the modern Orthodox. He didn't like the term necessarily modern Orthodox, but his students did, of the modern Orthodox rabbinate. And yet that wasn't enough. And I argue again, using folkways, because that's only when it is accepted in Israel. By women, principally, does it migrate in the United States? So it's a question of continuities and discontinuities. So it's really a question of what looks right. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, we have his letters. He is rather disturbed, even outraged at the prospect of how can you deny any Jew requisite levels of Jewish belief and Jewish literacy? And that's what he thought the Talmud represented, access to a full-fledged understanding of one's Jewishness.
Right. And what did the struggle over women's prayer groups look like? What were the contours of that conflict?
Yes, that I struggled with this chapter to understand.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
So I this was a good chapter to explore and to really test the limits of this method of lived religion, because here you have these women who were told that they aren't being Orthodox, they're being feminists. On the other hand, these women said they didn't use the word. They called it the F word, did these women. We didn't use the word feminism. Rivka Hout, one of its leaders, says if we wanted to pray at a conservative synagogue, we would, but we don't want to. And they're looking for to be authenticated. They're looking for Orthodox rabbinical groups to understand that we don't want egalitarianism. We want a separate women's space once a month. To pray, we will follow, we will make an understated as far as ritual is concerned. We will not recite certain items which are reserved only for a quorum of 10 men. And nevertheless, the pushback, and it surprises them, but it becomes the heated issue of the modern Orthodox community in the 1980s. It really does, because it interacts with, again, this conservative, the rise of the moral majority, and the Christian right at this time. It happens at an absolutely curious moment. Rabbi Soloveitchik, we just talked about, retires in the middle of it. Conservative Judaism has just started to ordain women in 1984 in earnest. And it's just this really freighted moment in which women's prayer groups, not a very large movement, it is receiving all of this interest because of everything that it has come to represent about women's space, about male space. How can you call yourself a women's tefillah group, a women prayer group, women's minyan? They said, we're not a minyan. A minyan, a quorum, a Hebrew word for quorum, is men. We're a prayer group. And it's so interesting about how the dynamics of how they use verbiage, they use language as best as possible to separate itself, to make itself authentic, kosher, and nevertheless, and nonetheless, the backlash.
Right. And I'm just curious, what's the status today of Orthodox, of women's prayer groups among Orthodox?
So it's no longer the burning issue. There's been much ado over what we call partnership minyanim, where men and women are participating together, and women at different levels, started in Israel, migrated in to the United States. What's so interesting is that when you follow up with some of these women from the women's prayer group era, from that epic, they want no part of partnership minyan. That level of egalitarian, they never wanted that in the first place. There are still women's prayer groups, but they're no longer that issue. In the community, partly because to a certain extent, that momentum was squashed. Some do exist. I don't want to suggest otherwise. But both in terms of who's interested, and it's also a different generation who is executing these things, who's interested and what it means, it's no longer the burning issue. Some do exist, certainly.
Right. Well,
there are always attempts to revive things.
Right. Well, before I can't let you go without asking you about Country Yossi's song "Deaf Man in the Shtiebel." As someone who was a very avid fan of the popular ultra-orthodox singer Country Yossi and this particular song, could you tell us a little bit about the song and how just how authentically Orthodox Jewish is this song?
Right. Now I know you've read the book cover to cover because that's the conclusion. So there's this song that I played for my students. In fact, I play it every semester when I teach a course like this on Orthodox Judaism in the United States. And there's the song "Deaf Man in a Shtiebel," and I confess I cry every time. I cry every time about a cantor. He's late on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, because he's found out his father has just died. His father is the deaf man in the shtiebel in the small synagogue space somewhere in Eastern Europe. He's deaf. So while he always sat in the back listening, presumably listening, but not really, because he can't hear anything, at least witnessing his son, the talented cantor, pray every Sabbath, every holiday, every Yom Kippur. He's died. And he's late as this cantor. The rabbi asks, "How come so late?" And he says, "My father just died." So the lyric goes, "It's the first time that my father's heard me pray, and now I'm already getting teary-eyed."
But <Me too. laughs>
the song is patterned after a 1970s, I believe, song about blind man in the bleacher. And it's not about a cantor. It's about a quarterback, about a football player, whose father, it's a different deficiency. It's not, it's not about being deaf. It's now the blind man in the bleacher. He's never seen his son throw pass a football. Now that he's in heaven, he's going to win. He does. Leads his team to victory in the second half. It's not, where the rabbi asks, "How come so late?" Again, a certain inflected yeshivish Yiddishism there. The song in the 70s is "Where the Hell You Been?" So it's a little more gruff. To the coach asks. And it's the first time that my father's seen me play. And I still cry. It's still moving. Even though it's a fiction. The song is borrowed. It is transformed from a very popular American folksy song. But that's not the point. The point is that it pulls at your heartstrings. It's a way to measure emotion. And to me, it's glaringly obvious that authenticity plays such a pivotal role in our American religious experience.
Right, right. Well, you've really given us so much to think about. Okay, here's the last question. Sure. Could you tell us about a new project that you're currently working on?
Yeah, so there's a book under review right now, a manuscript under review on football. We've talked so much about sports, but basketball, here's about football. It's about a Protestant, a Catholic, and a Jew. It sounds like a joke. In the 1920s, who transform the hierarchy of Harvard culture, when Harvard was the greatest football program in the country. It's been a long time. It's been 100 years. And how Bill Bingham, this mill hand who he has a very Calvinist type of New England last name, Bingham, but he's not that type of Bingham. And Eddie Casey, a Catholic fellow from Natick, Massachusetts, one of 15 children from a very pious Catholic family, and Arnold Harween from a Jewish family in Chicago, actually. And how the three of them inject a certain level of pluralism into the high towers of Harvard's campus. So that's hopefully going to appear soon, looking forward. And then right now I'm thinking a lot about not necessarily a Jewish question, but one about American religion and American culture. More about American culture is the concept of greatness. In America, we like to talk about the greatest of all time. who was the greatest president, who was the greatest athlete, who was the greatest musician. You know, in England, you know, there was some discussion about the Beatles, but we in America made the Beatles the greatest of all time, replacing Elvis Presley in the popular consciousness. And I want to explore Mickey Mouse versus Donald Duck, for example. And I can go on and on about this. Greatest women of all time. Americans, greatest scientists, are obsessed with these ranking orders. And I want to explore. I don't want to solve the dilemma. I'm not interested in Lincoln versus Washington or Elvis versus the Beatles or Peyton Manning versus Tom Brady. Although there, I think it's Peyton Manning over Tom Brady. my point is to understand what's going on in the discourse. Why do we care so much about it? It's not so much of why is Michael Jordan the greatest basketball player of all time, even though he absolutely is. It's a question of what is happening in the 80s and 90s around race and culture that is provoking Americans to have that conversation.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Thank you so much, Zev, for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thanks for having me. This is a blast.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.